Okay. And if I sit here, can the people on the Zoom see me or
Yeah, but you're going to have to project a
speak,
little bit
project?
because you're talking basically to this one.
Okay.
And yeah.
Okay. All right. So welcome everybody to the October 2024 National Capital Astronomers Monthly Meeting. And we have a wonderful speaker, Benedict Deemer, who is going to be talking to us about dark matter and stuff like that. Anybody have any announcements before I have give my announcements? Anybody online want to give an announcement?
Well, I just have one thing. I'm not seeing a full screen here. I see you in the corner in a very small screen,
Well, I'm very
but
small.
Well, that's something on your end where you have to choose the presentation of your Zoom screen. So if you're not, so right now Benedict is sharing his screen. So we've got his graphics up. And then the box with all the people, like the way I usually set it up is I have it as a bar above the presentation.
Yeah, I'm not going to talk for very long at all. By the way, who saw the auroras? Show of hands. Okay.
Oh, few.
I did not. I missed it. I was doing sidewalk astronomy instead, and by the time we got out, it was over. In 2 weeks, the Hopewell Observatory is going to have an open house. They are approximately 30 miles west of here, out I-66, and there's blurbs about that in the latest Exploring the Sky. In 3 weeks, we have Exploring the Sky again in Rock Creek Park. We always need people to do that. We also need volunteers for tech stuff. We could use people who are good at X or Twitter and just maintaining a website and or Facebook. And after the meeting here, some of us are going to go to meet up Korean barbecue at 8503 Baltimore Avenue. And that is pretty much all the announcements I have. Anybody else? Any last call for announcements?
Okay.
Okay. I'm going to turn it over to Carl at this point.
There are a few quick words here.
Yeah. Are you sure that's it?
Yeah.
Should be like church,
myself
sort of stand.
So as we're all aware, I think we're all aware, that the two biggest questions, or two of the biggest questions in modern physics and cosmology today, are what is the nature of dark energy and what is the nature of dark matter? And President Guy reminded us yesterday in an email, and then as we just discussed a few minutes ago here, Vera Rubin, who is generally considered one of the main people who established the existence of dark matter, and for whom one of NASA's upcoming great observatories is named, the Rubin Observatory, was an NCA member early in her career. So it's quite appropriate tonight that we have Dr. Benedict Deemer as our speaker, who is a noted expert in the field of dark matter. He has a PhD in astronomy from the University of Chicago. And afterwards, he did a postdoctoral position at Harvard. After that, he came here, I think it was 2019, if I read and since 2020, he's been assistant professor in the Department of Astronomy here at the University of Maryland. The research group that he leads here specializes in supercomputer simulations of dark matter structures and behavior. And reading his, going over through his website and the University of University of Maryland websites, web pages, you can find a long list of awards and grants and fellowships that Dr. Diemer has received, including things like the Sloan Research Fellowship and the Einstein, the NASA Einstein Fellowship, and many others. And he also does a significant amount of outreach, as you can see on the various web pages, especially exploring the interplay between arts and science. Is that fair? And in particular, his website points out that he's a co-founder of the arts and science collaboration called The Fabric of the Universe over the last 10 years or so, which explores the connection between, get this now, explores the connection between dark matter and woven textiles. So you can see a very creative mind at work here. And I urge everyone to take a look at that website, The Fabric of the Universe. It's an experience in itself. So I'm eager to hear what Benedict has to say about his dark matter researches, and let's welcome him.
Thanks, Kai. Thanks for having me. So I'm not going to talk about Fabric of the Universe stuff tonight. It's been a while since we had an installation. I would really like to get back to it, you know. Starting this job at UMD has been not entirely unstressful, you know, as you might imagine. But I feel like I have sort of mental room for it again. So if you know of any cool exhibition spaces in DC or any kind of sort of arts funding, you know, there's always an issue to get money for these sorts of things. I think we're basically ready to think about it again. Anyway, I wasn't totally sure, you know, what everyone's background is, you know, how much y'all have heard about dark matter. I didn't know Vera Rubin was in this club. I would have probably, I don't know, even chosen a different topic or something, you know. But please just interrupt me if anything's unclear, right? Or tell me to speed up if I'm telling you stuff y'all already know. This is really meant to be totally informal. Like, I have no attachment to any number of slides to get through or anything like that. So I called this where to look for dark matter, right? Because, maybe we still have to convince some people that dark matter exists, which I love. And then the question is, where should we look to do this, right? I mean, if we look at the night sky in Maryland, I mean, what do we see? I mean, you know, stars, right? We see stars in our own galaxy. If we go to Chile, we see the Milky Way. Right? It was Galileo who first figured out that the disk, well, that the Milky Way band is just a disk of dense stars. And then if we're in the south, we might see the Magellanic Clouds and maybe Andromeda, right? By naked eye, we're very, very lucky, right? So we can already see our galaxy and other galaxies. And in fact, those are sort of our first dark matter detectors, right? I mean, I know you all know this, just the recap, right? I mean, we're going around the galaxy every, I don't know, 250 million years or so. And that orbit is fundamentally just given by Newton's laws, right? I mean, if we want to get theoretical for a second, we have some sort of balance between forces. The gravity pulls us, as in the whole solar system, the sun inwards, and the centrifugal or centripetal force is sort of, you know, telling us we want to go on a straight line, right? And so if we, with a mass, then this is the gravitational force. So you have the gravitational constant mass and the mass of the sun, say, over r squared, and then the centripetal force is mv squared over r, v is the distance. And so we just solve this equation for a velocity, which is then gm over r, take the root of that. And that's exactly what we see in the solar system, right? If you plot the mean distance from the sun versus the orbital speed, with Mercury going quite fast, Pluto going quite slow, and this curve is just 1/√ of the radius. And that's about the last math I'm going to show you in this talk, right? I just wanted to highlight this, right? Because it is, I mean, it's really quite simple in a way, right? I mean, there's not that much you can debate about this unless you don't believe in Newton's laws. So what I'm prepping you for, of course, is using that to find dark matter. If we can look at a galaxy spinning around, for example, because we're seeing one side blue shifted and the other side red shifted in light, And by the way, it's not easy to do that in our own galaxy, actually, right? Because we're looking through so much messiness, you know, dust, stars, gas, whatever. But in other galaxies, it's arguably, I mean, honestly, one of the easier things to see in the universe, right? So we see the galaxy spin. And that's, of course, what Vera Rubin did, right? She was looking at what's called rotation curves, as in you look at different radii away from the center of the galaxy. And what you'd expect to find if the stars are all you see, it's going to be something like this, right? So this is radius in 1,000 light years, rotation velocity. You can see where the stars are, right? You convert the star light to star mass, and then you get a prediction for what you'd expect for this rotation. And you certainly expect it to fall off, right? Once you get to the stellar edge, you get to that one over root one over r stage, right? And the sun, the mass is entirely concentrated at the center. It's not in the galaxy, but it's still somewhat concentrated once you're out here, right? It should look a lot like this just Keplerian going around of stuff. And it just does not, right? I mean, if we look at galaxies, they look more something like this. In fact, here are some, here's sort of a visual representation of this, right? If you have only matter at the center, then you expect something like this, where in the center you're going around quite fast, but here you're going around very slowly. But if you have a lot more stuff, then you would expect something like this, where even in the outskirts you're going around fairly fast. And I would argue to get around this is pretty difficult, right? You have to basically postulate that we don't understand gravity if you want to get around this, and because it literally is just very basic laws of dynamics. And indeed, you know, galaxies around us, so these are pretty modern measurements. So this is the rotation curve of the Milky Way of our own galaxy. And you absolutely cannot explain this unless either there is more stuff than the stars we see or gravity is wrong, right? Those are your two options. I'm sorry, that's it. That's the menu. So, you know, maybe our first, I don't know what your first inclination is. Whose first inclination would be gravity is wrong? Interesting. Okay, so
at least it's possible.
It's totally possible. I'm just saying, what seems more plausible to you, that there is stuff we can't see or that gravity is wrong? Who's for stuff we can't see? All right, it's the majority. It's also my inclination, I have to say. I mean, in astronomy, I think everything's complex, right? We never see everything at first sight. So I'm just intuitively, to me, the idea that we can't see everything is fine. I believe that, you know, the idea that our theory of gravity is wrong is okay, maybe, you know, but it's not maybe my first intuition, but we'll come back to that. So if you believe that gravity, our understanding of gravity is sort of correct, well, then you're left with this idea that, and this is sort of super comic version, we'll get into more detail later, but that there's a lot of dark matter, basically. And I'm going to talk a lot about this concept of halos, right? These balls of dark matter that galaxies sit in. So you have a galaxy at the center, and it's really only 1-2% the size of the halo. And we'll come back to what I mean by size of the halo as well. And the dark matter is sort of denser at the center. So that's how we should imagine this, right? That the Milky Way is sitting in this big ball of dark matter, and that every galaxy is sitting in a big ball of dark matter. And in fairness to people who came before Vera Rubin, she wasn't actually the first person to suggest this, right? So there are also these objects in the sky called galaxy clusters, where you just have a lot of galaxies piled up. And if you think that those are also bound by gravity, you can actually take the velocities of these galaxies. So again, it's not dissimilar to looking at a rotation curve, right? You're again using velocities to basically test how much gravity do you need for this thing not to just fly apart? And because if the velocities are very, very high, stuff's just going to go away. But if gravity wins, okay, then you can keep it together, right? And so Fritz Zwicky famously did this already in the 1930s, looking at the coma cluster, and he concluded it would be ripped apart, right? If you only take the mass that you can see in starlight, it's not even close, right? This thing would just go, and it clearly hasn't. So what gives? Now, Zwicky was famously disagreeable person, right, to the point where they apparently at Caltech gave him an office in some faraway basement, you know, even though he was super famous. But he was apparently a really nasty person, but very smart. So he is often claimed to have coined this term, dunkle materie, dark matter. But actually, the term apparently goes back to even earlier papers, even in the 1920s, people were talking about dunkle materie. So I'm not totally sure who first started calling it that. Any questions about this part? So finding dark matter by, yeah.
So the rotation was as expected, where the core is spinning faster than the outer edge. Would that mean that the arms would be stretched out over time?
Ah, great question. Yeah. So going back to this movie. I don't know if we can really see it in this movie. This is just a comic, right? These are not real galaxies or real simulations even. So spiral arms of galaxies are actually not moving with the rotation. It's a little sort of counterintuitive, right? It seems like when you look at them, you would think that spiral arms form a sort of a line and then they get sort of sheared, right? But if that were true, we go around the galaxy every 225 million years or so, right? The universe is our galaxy is probably 10 billion years old. So we've gone around like 40 times. Right? So the spiral arms would be crazy wound up. And so just from that consideration, they cannot move with the material in the galaxy. Turns out that spiral arms are actually, they're more like pressure waves. So you can think of them, this is a horribly complicated topic and I don't want to get into it too much, but they basically exist in gas as sort of density waves that are going through the gas and triggering stars to form. That's why they look blue. And in stars, they're like a traffic jam. So, you can make a traffic jam without really ever cars running into each other. They're sort of just condensing and then condensing again. Does that make sense?
Like 495.
Yeah, basically. Exactly. It's just like rush hour, for the stars. Anyway, so this is actually, by the way, this is an amazing fact that spiral arms are still not fully explained. Like you read even the textbooks on this and it's super confusing. I had to teach this recently and I was like sitting there like, what? Like none of it really makes any sense. And so we have ideas about how spiral arms form and so on, and you can simulate it, right? But there's not a beautiful analytic theory. Anyway, the main point is you should not think of the disk as being sort of a solid object that rotates, right? It's more just stuff and the spiral arms can sort of move across the disk. Good. Any other questions on this? All right. So since we have at least one dark matter skeptic, we should always take the temperature, right? So how convinced are you that dark matter exists? So far, okay, what have we shown? We've shown something has to give, right? Either there is more stuff than we can see or a lot more, or gravity is different from our understanding, as in from Newtonian gravity or general relativity. And so far, I haven't really convinced you of either, I guess. So what's a totally different dark matter detector we could try? Any thoughts? Lensing's one, yeah. I'm not going to talk about lensing. Lack of time. Any other suggestions?
Collider.
Yeah, interesting. One, like physical on-Earth detection. I'm thinking of something totally different. So it turns out the cosmic microwave background is actually a really good dark matter detector and one that's not talked about often enough. So this next bit gets a little technical. So again, just stop me if something doesn't make sense. But I think it's worth talking about because this is so often ignored by people who say they're not sure dark matter exists. So I'm going to present the evidence to you and then we'll see how we feel about it. So how many of you know what the cosmic microwave background is and how we measure it? Yeah, most people, but okay, let's remind ourselves, right? So when we look in the sky, we have microwaves coming from everywhere, right? They're basically at a fixed temperature. So temperature being like the distribution is such that they look a lot like the infrared emission from your body, for example, due to your body temperature. They have this characteristic black body spectrum, but at a very low temperature of 2.7 Kelvin. Right? And so we're very convinced that they're basically leftover heat radiation from the Big Bang when the universe is very hot. That radiation then eventually, when the universe becomes transparent, goes in all directions. And sort of it's like looking at a campfire, except now very stretched out because space has expanded so much. Anyway, so that's your very, very quick intro. But the point is that the pattern is not completely uniform, right? They have these very small deviations, 1 in 100,000 or so, across the sky. And we can sort of make some sky map, like a globe, where we plot whether this temperature is low in blue or high in red. And again, it's just a tiny difference, right? That it's basically all the same temperature, but with these tiny patches, and these different satellites have measured this to higher and higher accuracy. So here is the beautiful, famous map from the Planck satellite from 2018, whenever their final data release was. So what we're seeing is that initially, basically a few 100,000 years after the Big Bang, the universe was very uniform, but not entirely uniform. And it had these slightly hotter and slightly colder patches. Now, why? Because quantum mechanics, right? I mean, it's like the coolest explanation for anything in astrophysics, but in my opinion, right? Literal quantum fluctuations in the very, very first moments of the universe, because quantum mechanics says you don't really know, like nature doesn't know exactly where particles are and how they move at the same time. And so you cannot have, by construction, you cannot have totally smooth density, right? Because nature just doesn't even know how to do that. You know, there's always random noise. And then the random noise gets amplified by something crazy called inflation. And so you end up with this spot pattern, or the spot pattern is random. It could have happened any million different ways. And this is the one that, I don't want to say our universe was left at. This is the one that we see from our position. This is actually the spot pattern in a big sphere around us, basically, right? That we happen to observe now because the light has been traveling to us for 14 billion years. Gets a bit technical, but whatever. Now, how does this tell us about dark matter? Well, to understand that, we have to get a little more technical even and think about how do we describe a pattern like this. So we basically do what's called a power spectrum, right? So you can imagine, like, you know, sound waves you can decompose into sine waves of different frequencies. And then you can, instead of just giving the wave of a song or something or my voice or whatever, you can decompose this into long and short and shorter waves and say, we have so and so much of this wave and so on. And so you can do something similar with the spot pattern. You can look at, okay, a dipole, for example, is one half of the sky is colder and one half is hotter. And then you can do the quadrupole, which means you have these sort of multiple, like 4 or 8 patches, octopole and so on and so forth. And so you can decompose this map into these different components. And then what you get is a plot like this, where you have sort of size. So this is like big sizes, and then the sizes get smaller and smaller. So it's basically 180 degrees over the size of the spot. And then on here, let's not worry about it. It's just sort of how strong are the fluctuations, right? So this is the data from Planck. So what we're seeing is basically at about 1 degree, right? So 200 over 180, about 1 degree, you have this peak, right? This is just saying there is a lot of fluctuations with roughly that size. If we go back to our map, it's actually sort of tracks. I mean, if you sort of squint, right? If you look by eye, you see maybe a lot of patches of about sort of this size, right? And these are indeed these 1 degree-ish patches. It's not easy to see by eye, right? I mean, you certainly can't make out the whole spectrum, but I think that you can convince yourself of. At least you're not seeing, like, I don't know, 20-degree patches or something like that. Right?
That's not an artifact of the resolution of the Planck measurements.
No. I mean, you see some bigger ones, right? This is called the cold spot, this big blue thing here, right? There is some bigger patches. And this is what we're saying when we're not plotting this, right? So the power, for example, is not zero on very large scales, right? There is some changes there, but the majority is sort of on 1 degree scales, and then it has this crazy shape, right? Weird wiggles, and the physics is quite complicated. So this has to do with what happens in the very early universe. And now I'm going to show you the thing that convinces us that we know anything. If we take our model of the universe, a universe with normal matter, our matter, dark matter, an expansion. What else do you need? I think that's about it, in fact. This is what you get. Now, I didn't put error bars on these points, but the reason kind of is that you wouldn't even see the error bars, right? That's how good this measurement is. And this is the prediction from our theory of the universe with a few free parameters. So there's a few free numbers that you get to tune, you know, namely how much
normal matter there is, how much dark matter there is, and how much expansion there is, and so on. Six numbers. This is very convincing, right? I mean, this is not an easy thing to reproduce. But what I want to get at, the reason I'm telling you about all this, is now the following. So this prediction actually implies that this number omega m, this is basically how much total matter there is 0.31, is meaning sort of a third of the total energy density of the universe today is in matter. We'll come back to what that means. Here is what you'd predict if you make that 40% instead of 31%. Huh. Why? What's happening? So when you change how much matter there is, you change how the CMB looks. You change the sizes of these spots. And this has to do with this crazy early universe physics, right? So you have these initial spots, and then gravity is trying to pull the denser regions together. And then you have radiation going around and gas pushing back, and it's really, really complicated. But you can use a computer code. That's what I've done here when I made these curves. I used someone else's computer code that can predict this. And I just put in, hey, give me a universe with 40% matter. And bam, it predicts this different pattern of spots. This is what happens if I go down to 20%. And this is what you get when you have no dark matter. It is a 120 sigma detection of dark matter. Like you're 120 times off, the error bars off when you don't include dark matter. So I just really want to let that sink in, right? This is the one thing that people who say dark matter doesn't exist typically ignore. But you can't ignore it, right? I mean, it's a huge detection.
Is lambda still present?
Yeah, this is actually still a 70% dark energy universe. Yeah. But if it actually, like, lambda does not have so much influence on the CMB. If you set that to zero, it's still totally off.
So omega m
the fraction of the total energy density that is in matter today. So back then, the lambda was actually completely insignificant. You can ignore it basically because the universe was so small. So the energy density of matter back then was effectively 100%, but you can still change this number. So it's extrapolated to today, basically. That's how we express these parameters. But to be clear, if I left in, this is omega baryons, right, so the normal matter, I'm leaving that in, right? So this green universe still has all the normal matter that you need to make stars. It just doesn't have any dark matter. Yeah, and you just get this completely wrong, right? Your spots are, I don't know, your fluctuations are way too big. And to explain exactly why it makes these patterns is really tricky. You have to really get into it. But that theory is well developed. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is way off the mark, but it's the back of my head. Negative energy is off by 10 to 120.
Oh, that's just a coincidence. Yeah, so you're talking about dark energy being 120 orders of magnitude off from the one potential prediction you could make for it, which is the zero point energy. So I'm not talking about dark energy today. It's a whole different fascinating topic.
The number stuck in my head. I was maybe.
Yeah, so the number 120 sigma, I would have to go back. I think that's true for the Planck data set, whether it's 100, you can argue about this, right? Yeah. The point is it's an enormous number, right? You cannot explain the CMB, like this spot pattern that we see is clearly from a universe where you had a lot of extra matter, a lot of extra gravity, basically. And it has, to my knowledge, not been explained by any modification to gravity, not even close. So people have tried. And again, like, I mean, there was actually one of my mentors at the University of Chicago back in, I don't know, 2013 or something, wrote a paper about this, just pointing out this obvious fact, right? That these theories like Mohn, they just ignore this, right? And they just, like, you ask these people and they're like, let's talk about something else. So, but you know, what do you mean talk about something? Like, I mean, this is there. Your theory has to explain it, or you can't just go home, you know? Anyway, I get a little mad about the way this is sometimes treated sociologically. Anyway, any other questions about the CMB measurement?
Who is doing the counting of the spots? Are you enslaving some undergrads to stare at a computer screen of like a certain resolution and classifying it? Or have you got a like or machine learning approach?
So to be clear, I don't do any of this. This is in this case done by the Planck team, which is European collaboration. So no, luckily no undergrads were harmed in the making of this power spectrum, as far as I know, at least not in the way that you're saying by counting spots. No, when you do this decomposition, it's actually just a mathematical operation. And you take this map and you essentially project it onto the spaces of these projecting you sort of multiply and I don't know how to explain this in super simple terms, and I've never done it myself, so I don't want to talk nonsense. But yeah, you basically just sort of seeing how well each of these components fits the map.
One other thought. I guess so when you started the talk, you talked about, you know, there are two paths. There's a dark matter path and the gravity. I generally believe in dark matter. But the thought that came to mind, I guess, is we can't really reconcile gravity with quantum mechanics. And so it seems to me there is something wrong with gravity or quantum mechanics, I guess. You know, you can go either way there, I guess. Is if you could reconcile those, is there any way that would kind of fit with this scheme to...
That's a good question. So I want to be very clear, right? I'm completely open-minded towards modifications to gravity, 100%. As you say, right? I mean, we have general relativity. It doesn't fit quantum field theory, which is our theory for everything else. So yeah, physics is not complete, right? I mean, if anyone tells you otherwise, they're making stuff up, right? We're clearly not at the final answer, whatever that is, and if it even exists. I hope it does. We should always be open-minded. Any theory, I guess what I'm saying is any theory that can explain all the data, let's have it, right? I'm just allergic to people who claim to have a theory that is sort of universal and then ignoring a glaring part of the data, right? Like that's what you can't do. But yeah, modified gravity is still in and we'll actually come back to it, but not as a replacement for dark matter. I think that's also a common misunderstanding. And most modified gravity people, they actually get very defensive when they get thrown into one pot with the dark matter deniers, because that's not what they mean anymore anyway. They actually want to explain dark energy.
Okay.
So it's almost clearly different enterprise, but because there's these people, namely the Mond folks, you know, who have made it their business to claim that their theory can replace dark matter, they got a sort of a bad rep, you know? Yeah. Good.
So I'm wondering then who has the worst of rep, the people trying to spin away dark matter or the one that are on the FTL?
The faster than light. I mean, you're asking an astrophysicist. I have a biased opinion, you know. I think the people who are trying to avoid dark matter have the worst rep, but I'm not in particle physics, you know. I'm sure they have something to say about the FTL people too. Yeah. Okay, good. Enough of this. So what are we taking away from this, right? So the CMB basically gives us this exquisitely accurate measurement of the contents of the universe. And here's the pie chart. So we think that today, so there's sort of 70% dark energy, we're sort of ignoring in this talk because we only have so much time. And then we have matter, which is about the remaining 30%. And of that 80% or 25% of total, is dark matter, and only 5% is the ordinary stuff that we are made of, that stars are made of, that galaxies are made of. So I would sort of claim that maybe the more interesting, the more modern question is maybe not so much does dark matter exist. I personally feel like we need to get over that. I think it does. But ask, well, if it does, then what is it, right? I mean, I think that's a much more interesting way to approach this. Because to me, philosophically, believing in dark matter is just not so hard, right? I mean, so what is it? Well, we don't know. It could be a million things, right? I mean, if we believe it's a particle, I mean, it could be one or multiple particles, right? I mean, it could be a whole zoo of particles. There are so many particles that we've only found in the second half of the 20th century. Is it really philosophically so hard to believe that we haven't found certain particles yet? I mean, sure, there's a standard model of particles and dark matter isn't part of it, right? Otherwise, we would have seen it by now. So it's not like trivial, I'm not saying that, but I mean, I just think the idea that we found every single particle is just absurd. So to me, that is not hard to believe in. So the point is that this dark matter that we're believing in, right, like if we believe in it, then does not interact with our normal world, right? This is an important point. If it did, then we would have seen it a long time ago, right? You'd see it everywhere in physics, right? Like these dark matter particles would bounce into us right now. I mean, we'd be sitting in a wind, right? Because we're going through the galaxy. There's a 220 kilometer per second dark matter wind in this room right now. But the dark matter is going right through us. It's going through my brain right now and through your brain as well. And it can do that because it just doesn't interact, right? It's just going right through all the other atoms. They're not seeing each other except via gravity, which is a very weak force in this room. And so, yeah, we're just unaware of each other almost. Does that make sense? You know, I mean, that's the picture I'm drawing here. So, of course, as someone already mentioned, people are trying to find the dark matter, right? So, in fact, there are many experiments, like in this case, xenon 1T, named for 1 ton of xenon, you know, which are basically doing this. They go to some basement. By basement, I mean like a 3,000 kilometer deep mine, or no, 3,000 meter deep mine or something like that. It's all a very crazy experiment. And then you take a ton of xenon and you make it super pure and you isolate it from anything else. And then you're building detectors around it and you're trying to see literally dark matter particles interacting with the xenon in the hope that what I said before is not entirely true, right? That they interact a tiny little bit that we could detect. And so far, you know, no luck. But of course, this is one of the biggest problems in physics, right? I mean, and if you find the dark matter, the next thing that happens is you're on a plane to Stockholm, right? Guaranteed Nobel Prize the next day, basically, right? So, you know, people are trying. It would be amazing. But what makes this so hard is not least the fact there are so many possibilities. I don't even want to look at this scary graphic. This is just sort of a comic version of all the different possibilities, right? So big dark matter particles, whatever this means, you know, neutrinos, tiny particles, even tinier particles, and then modified gravity. But, you know, so MOND is the one that I think is sort of crackpot at this point, you know, but they put it on here. Why not? You know, let's be inclusive. So there is this whole zoo of possibilities from very heavy to incredibly light particles. You just don't know, right? There's, again, 100 orders of magnitude in particle mass. And so this makes it very hard for people who are building this stuff, because you can only build an experiment to detect sort of a narrow range of this sort of possibility space. And for many of these particles, we don't even have any ideas how to detect them yet, right? So we're looking at this enormous space of possibility and we're putting down little dots and saying, okay, it's not this, you know, but there's still so much space remaining. So it's really hard enterprise. And so where I'm getting at this is, you know, I'm an astrophysicist, and so again, I'm biased, but I think that it is looking more and more likely that the answer will need to come from astrophysics, basically, that we need to look for dark matter in the sky, which is sort of what we turn to the beginning of this talk. What can we see in the sky that might tell us what dark matter is? Because after all, I just showed you the CMB, but that's the very beginning of the universe. Time is going left to right in this famous comic. You have the Big Bang, and then quick expansion, CMB. Well, and then you have the entire rest of 14 billion years, right? Where some very interesting things happen, and you make a lot of galaxies, for example, that we see in the sky. And this is really the part that I'm interested in my research. So the idea being, right, in the beginning, you have these very, very slightly more or less dense regions. And then what happens is the denser regions exert more gravity. So they pull in more stuff. Hence, they get denser, right? And this is a positive feedback loop that basically means stuff eventually collapses, right? And this is why the universe isn't super boring, right? If everything had just stayed at even density, well, then we wouldn't be around, right? Because there would be no stars, no galaxies, no planets, nothing interesting. It would just be a soup. But luckily, it is not so. So what do we do now? It'd be nice if we could write down some equations to sort of tell us now what happens. But this process becomes very chaotic and nonlinear, and so it cannot be solved mathematically. We need computer simulations which I love because I like programming and computers. So what we do is, we basically build a artificial cube of universe and put in a lot of virtual particles, like a billion or so. We just say, okay, let's simulate our dark matter particles. For now, we're going to ignore the normal matter because dark matter is the majority. Let's understand that first. And so we displace these initial positions to make a pattern that corresponds to the spot pattern of the CMB, not the exact one, but sort of in a random sense has the same properties. And then we let our computer do its thing, right? So we start from totally uniform little cube of universe, and we just let gravity attract these particles, and then we wider color, like wider color means higher density. And so we're seeing how gravity is starting to collapse all the matter into what we call the cosmic web. And you can see why it's called the cosmic web. It makes all these filaments and voids. It also makes walls that are kind of hard to see. And then it makes these bright spots, which are the halos that we talked about earlier, right? Like these balls of dark matter that we now see are not really all that spherical and so on. This is one of my simulations, by the way. So, yeah, you don't even need, I mean, you need like a good computer to do this, but not even that crazy a computer. You can't run these on your laptop, but.
Is this supposed to be a small fraction of the universe or the whole?
No, so this is, that's a really great question. So it's supposed to be a representative cube of universe. And you can run different sizes of cubes and so on that informs what you get out. You cannot actually do it for the real universe because we do not know the beginning state of the real universe. We see the CMB, but again, the CMB is a shell of light that just happens to be reaching us, and everything inside and outside the shell we cannot see. Mm-hmm. And so you cannot start a simulation from that. There's no way you can use a shell to start a simulation. So we don't know. This is not our real universe. This is a random version of a universe.
Mm-hmm. But it is similar to what's observed.
Yeah, let me get to that in a second. Okay. So yeah, you shouldn't, don't believe me yet. You know, I haven't convinced you at all that this is realistic, right? So just to like give you sort of little insight into what happens here. So this is a logarithmic color scale, right? So white is like 100,000 times the mean density of dark matter. Dark is maybe 100. So the halos get very dense. And then we just have to remind ourselves of these insane scales, right? So there's like a billion light years or something like that, right? So this cosmic web is really, really large. The Milky Way galaxy would not even be a pixel in this image. You wouldn't be able to see it. We can zoom into these images. We basically see that there's more and more structure. How will we zoom in? This was the title image of this talk, right? The simulated halo. To zoom into that further, you see there's like little subhalos, as we call them, halos within halos and so on. And a lot of my work has been sort of understanding this better, which is funny because, you know, people started studying this in the 80s, 90s in these early computer simulations. But there's still cool things we can learn. So in this video, I'm focusing on one big halo that's forming, and you can actually see that there's sort of this boundary around this halo, and there's like this sort of place to which matter comes out, so matter falls in, and then it comes out the other side and goes to this sort of fairly well-defined boundary, which hadn't really been appreciated before. And so we saw this in some of my simulations. And so we started calling this the splashback radius. It became like, this is kind of a silly name, but it became sort of a new idea of where a halo actually ends, right? I mean, you can see the halo doesn't exactly end, right? Because you've got these filaments pointing into it. But if it ends somewhere, I would claim it ends about here. And so this is then interesting because it changes your whole idea of dark matter halos. So for example, if you think about the dark matter around the Milky Way and Andromeda, so this is a schematic, but if the Milky Way is here, this is the Andromeda galaxy. The blue dots are all the little satellite galaxies around them, right? So this, the SMC, LMC are in here somewhere. And then conventionally people call the dark matter halos sort of these rings, but I'm saying they're actually much bigger, right? So if you look at this, what I would call the natural boundary, and we don't know what they are for the Milky Way and Andromeda, we haven't seen the dark matter, right? But it's probably something like this. So this means they overlap, right? And so you have all these satellites that actually, they can always be interchangeable because we're colliding with Andromeda, right? So our halos are already actually overlapping. Anyway, it's just one fun consequence of rethinking these. So where does the halo end? So that was just a little aside, you know, some of the stuff I've been interested in. But I want to come back to Carl's question about observations. But again, we can't see any of the dark matter. So how do I know any of this makes any sense? So, you know, we have these halos in simulations here. I've marked them with red circles. But in the halos, we have galaxies, right? So in a small halo, we might have a little dwarf galaxy. In a bigger halo, we might have a Milky Way or something like that. And then in a really big halo, we might have one of these big galaxy clusters that, Zwicky was observing, like the Coma cluster. And it turns out that even from these very simple dark matter-only simulations, there's a very simple way to make the connection. You can do something it's so basic, it's almost shameful, right? Just say, okay, let's take the sort of population of galaxies that we're seeing in the sky, right? There's a distribution from big to small. And now I take similar volumes of observed galaxies and of simulation. And I just put the biggest galaxy in the biggest halo, second biggest galaxy, second biggest halo, and so on. I mean, it's almost like, you know, it's bizarrely simple, right? Given how complex all of this is. And what you find is that you then, the way you distribute light is really a lot like observations, right? It really matches what we see in the sky in terms of the way galaxies are distributed. So here's an example of this in the famous Millennium simulation. So this is data, right? These are galaxies in the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. This is the first sky survey from the 90s. Here's another one. And we see these characteristic patterns that the galaxies make. What you're looking at is the cosmic web, right? So what's called the Sloan Weyl Wall. This is just a big filament where galaxies form. And this is the simulation. And just by eye, like the simulation was galaxies painted on in this way. It's just by eye, you see how similar these patterns are, right? So basically, we do see the cosmic web of dark matter in the sky. And this is, again, maybe our third dark matter detector. Because if you don't want to believe in dark matter, you need to explain this, right? That cosmic web doesn't form itself, you know? It's not easy to explain these patterns that we see in the sky without any dark matter.
So your simulation produced a great wall?
No. I mean, yes, well, yes and no. So did my simulation produce the Great Wall? No, because it's not actually the realistic our universe. Did it produce a Great Wall? Yeah, absolutely. So if we look at, zoom out again with this image, right? You see these filaments, you know, if you put galaxies in these halos, you're going to end up with things that look like a wall on the sky. Right? Okay, there we are. So yeah, so I think this is our third very powerful dark matter detector. And this is where I think, in a way, the interesting science is going to happen. I mean, to be clear, I really hope that our direct detection, one ton of xenon colleagues find dark matter one day. It'd be fantastic, you know? But I'm not convinced that it will happen in my lifetime or ever, you know? And so I think the astrophysical frontier is really powerful. So let me show you what I mean by that, because, okay, so far, maybe I'm just adding one more argument that dark matter exists. Okay, fine, whatever. We're already convinced. Boring. But we can do more, you know? Because actually now it turns out that the type of dark matter does start to influence things, right? So the rotation curve of the galaxy does not necessarily tell you what dark matter is. It doesn't tell you if the particle is heavy or light. The CMB doesn't tell you what the dark matter is. It just tells you that there's extra gravity. But it turns out that structure does actually depend on what dark matter is. So for example, one basic property is it cold or warm or hot, meaning how fast do the particles move randomly, right? Like if the air in this room is hot, it means the particles are moving a lot. So it's sort of an analogy for the dark matter. So if you have warm dark matter that has a lot more temperature, it doesn't make the smallest things because it just sort of randomly moves out of those little densities. So here is a cold dark matter simulation and a warm dark matter simulation. And the cold dark matter one makes just a lot more little things just by eye. And so we've known now since the late 80s, basically, dark matter cannot be hot. If the particles move really, really fast, then you just don't make enough halos to explain the galaxies in the sky. In fact, it can't even be all that warm. Dark matter is looking very cold, you know? Maybe not totally cold. There could be some motion, but we're pretty convinced that it cannot be all that warm. But there are more crazy ideas. I mean, I said dark matter is just sort of going through everything, right? It's not interacting. But what if it's interacting with itself a little bit? What if dark matter particles collide with other dark matter particles and sort of scatter like billiard balls? Well, on the left-hand side, you have a simulation of just pure cold dark matter. On the right-hand side, of some model for self-interacting dark matter. And up here, you look at it, it's the same picture, basically, right? And that's good, right? It means like on large scales, you could reproduce the same universe. But on small scales, you actually see differences where this makes a slightly smoother pattern, right? And so you might have different patterns of galaxies and sort of different distributions of sizes of halos and all that stuff. There's even more crazy ideas like quantum mechanical dark matter, where the particles are so light that quantum mechanics starts to matter, and they would make crazy interference patterns and so on. This is a simulation of a colleague of mine called Philip Moss, who pioneered this kind of stuff. This gets really crazy, right? So the dark matter makes like wave patterns and so on. I think this is probably not true. You know, this is probably not the universe we live in, but very fascinating idea. So
what the scale of that diagram?
Oh, that's a great question. I don't think there even is a scale. It could mean a big or a small thing. This is very idealized. In this field, they're not at the point yet where they can really run big simulations, unfortunately. Turns out simulating quantum mechanics is real hard. It's a lot harder than doing just Newtonian gravity. So here's where I want to go with this, basically. So here are a few simulations I ran. These are actually just small simulations. I ran those on a pretty small computer. Where I put in different, very exaggerated types of dark matter and modified gravity, by the way, right? So this is our standard cold dark matter idea, you know? Like if the dark matter is just that, right? It's dark matter, it doesn't interact, it's cold initially. And I found sort of halos, so in I ran what's called a halo finder code, and I marked in yellow the positions of these halos, and here's a little zoom in this region. Then I added the self-interacting dark matter. I let the particles collide a little bit. And I should say, I didn't even write this code. There's some other smart people who put this physics in the simulation code. Then someone else put what's called F of R gravity. So this is a model for modified gravity into this code. Now, this is, again, not to replace dark matter. There is still dark matter. I'm showing you the dark matter, right? But it replaces dark energy, basically, in these simulations. And you see there are some differences here. And then I put warm dark matter in, and it smooths everything out, right? So these are way exaggerated. Like, these are already totally excluded by observations. They cannot be true. I chose those just to, like, create visible differences, right? But that's the idea. So we want to run all different simulations of these different universes. I want to be mindful of time. So I'm at 45 minutes. Should I keep going for a bit? Should we stop here? And I go a little further, just explain this project to you that I want to do, you know?
And then we leave it there.
So this is dark matter only tiny simulations, you know? And people have done this before, to be clear. I'm not the first person to do this. But what I think is becoming possible now is something a little crazier. Because the problem is, right, I could run all these dark matter only simulations, but then I still have to sort of paint on the galaxies and compare to real observations, right? And the problem is it's going to be hard to convince you all, right? Because then you're like, well, okay, but how well do you really know what galaxies sit in what halos, right? Like, how sure are you about all this really complicated physics? And just to show you how complicated it is, I want to show you a movie from another simulation called Illustris. And this is a simulation where you do not only have dark matter. Now you have our normal matter as well. And so it gets infinitely more complicated. So I'm not even showing, the movie is not even showing you the dark matter. It's showing you the density of just gas. So this is sort of hydrogen, basically, which looks similar to dark matter. You know, it makes the cosmic web. And then up here you have stars. So you're starting to see these galaxies forming. And down here you have the temperature of this gas and this thickening along. And so as these galaxies are forming, you see again the galaxies are forming in the halos, right, at the densest spots of the dark matter. You'll start to see some big explosions in the temperature field in a second. Those are from supernovae and sort of all these complicated things that happen in galaxies. And so the whole takeaway from all this is really complicated, right? I mean, there's some mad physics going on. The simulation is not truth either, right? I mean, these simulations have to make big simplifications, and there's huge debate going on about how good they are and how bad, and, you know, people keep writing hundreds of papers about this, your supernova explosions from these galaxies. But the point is, at least you get out some prediction, right, for something that we might really observe in the sky, right? I mean, from this, you can now make a much more precise sort of idea of what we would observe. And again, it's not our universe, but it's statistically speaking a very similar universe, right? So here you could really go and take, okay, so what is the distribution of galaxy luminosities, and compare it to the real universe? But I cannot emphasize enough, like, you know, how complex galaxy formation really is. So here's a zoom in one of these simulations where we're focusing on one galaxy forming. So what you're seeing now is gas flow. So this is showing you the gas density. You're seeing how it's going to make a disk, basically just from the rotation of this gas coming in. Down here, you're seeing the corresponding dark matter. And here's a zoom onto this forming galaxy and the stars that are forming. And you see you're sort of going to make something like a Milky Way in this movie, embedded in a whole fake simulated universe. So this is, again, from this illustrious TNG suite of simulations. Now, by the way, this simulation cost, I believe, 120 million CPU hours, so as if you were running your laptop for 120 million hours. But these get really expensive, and they're really hard to do. And the team that did this invested an enormous amount of labor and time into it. But you see now in these simulations, you are making things that are looking, you know, not unrealistic, right? I mean, you're starting to make things like Milky Ways and so on. And so my goal is basically to run those kinds of simulations, but with all these different types of dark matter and modified gravity. And to sort of really think about what can then observations of galaxy clusters and maybe galaxies tell us about what type of universe we live in, right? Like what type of dark matter, what type of modified gravity, if it is then modified. And this is going to be really hard, you know, because these differences are small at this point, right? We know they have to be small. Otherwise, we would have already seen them. But that's the idea. Okay, let's stop there. So what I wanted you to take away from this was just, I think we see evidence for dark matter from many, many places in the universe, and there are many times, right? The very early universe, the CMB, today, our galaxy, right? So personally, I'm not in any doubt as to whether dark matter exists, but we still have almost no idea what it is, right? What particle is, if it is a particle, multiple particles, who knows, you know? And I think that observing sort of the structure, the sort of structure of things in the universe might very well be the path forward to finding out what dark matter is. Thanks. Thanks.
So we have time for a few questions. Our speaker has to leave soon.
Yeah, no worries. We have time for questions. That's all good.
Yeah. Dr. Deamer?
Yeah.
So we have one online. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah. We had another lecture in which they posited the fact that in addition to the four familiar dimensions, there could be another six. And I wonder, do you think it's possible that we could see dark matter in a different dimension, but one that that we don't normally deal with?
You're blowing my mind here. I mean, like, I know nothing. I mean, so I think you're talking about sort of a string theory universe with 11 dimensions total, right? Like, what's it, two times? No, I always get confused. I honestly know nothing about that. I mean, I think the reality is that we perceive a 3+1 dimensional universe, like three space and one time. And I don't know. I mean, even if these extra dimensions exist, I believe they have to be like rolled up or something, right? There has to be a mechanism by which they are hidden from our view, for lack of a better word. And so I think it is not clear to me that if they existed, that they would help us in any way to see dark matter, since we already can't see it in our dimensions. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Well, sorry.
I don't know what you can see. Has anybody ever seen anything in the other dimensions other than the four that are so familiar? Yeah.
So to be clear, I mean, the mainstream theory is that our universe is 3+1 dimensional and that space is flat, right? So that we actually live in the most boring version of general relativity, where space is sort of Euclidean, as you'd call it, right? So it's just like, you know, forward, backward, left, right, up, down, sort of, you know, just a cube, sort of infinite space where you just keep going straight in a straight line if you think you're going in a straight line. The universe could be curved or something like that. But there is no evidence whatsoever for these extra dimensions at this point.
Okay, so they may not exist.
They probably do not exist. Yeah.
Okay, Steve.
Maybe just to flip that question around. I think what I took from your talk is you don't need any modification at all of gravity. You think just the dark matter itself can kind of explain the evidence out there.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, maybe I should have been more clear about this, right? So currently. So we have this model that we call lambda CDM, right? I showed you this. This is this model with dark energy, lambda, and cold dark matter, CDM, right? That's what that stands for. That model can explain the CMB very well. We saw that with the gray line matching the gray points, right? Like really extremely well, I mean, scarily well, right? And it explains the distribution of galaxies in the sky, you know, at least quite well, I'd say. And it explains a million other things, right? So maybe the question then is, are we ready to go home, right? Are we done? Now, the answer is, it depends, you know? So some people claim that there are some things that are not clearly explained, and I would agree. I mean, so there are some details that we didn't get into today. For example, of these little dwarf galaxies, you know? There are some observations that are currently not super well matched by the simulations. But then running simulations that are really good is also really hard. That's what I was getting at in the end, right? You have to really simulate galaxy formation, and that can't really quite be done yet. So where you end up on this then is sort of a little bit depends on your, you know, inclination, right? So you can be more skeptical and say, oh, this doesn't quite match. I think our theory is all wrong. And some people are drawn to that psychology, right? Sort of a skepticism of the overall model. And then there are other people, and I would probably call myself into those mostly, who think that our current model explains the universe awfully well. So before I throw it overboard completely, I want to see some pretty strong evidence to the contrary. And I have not seen that evidence. But there are enough details that need to be sorted out that I think it's good to be open-minded. And the question of what dark matter is, so for example, is it self-interacting? Is it really completely cold and doesn't interact at all? Right? Those are genuinely open questions. And I think I want to be open-minded. I would love to simulate all the models that aren't ruled out yet. Right? Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. Thanks.
Clarification, the dark halo, is that like an approximation for dark matter? And is dark matter, is it always accompanying regular matter, or is it can just be like empty, almost empty state?
No, that's a good question. So if we go back to this movie, well, actually in this movie, you don't see it so well. So yeah, we can look at this gas density field. You have to remember what my simulations of dark matter looked like, right? So you also have these filaments and so on. So the answer is at very large scales, the gas does more or less follow the dark matter. So they're actually like coexisting, basically. They're both making the filaments, you know, and the voids and so on. And then at small scales, they sort of separate, like in the halos, right? Suddenly the physics of the gas becomes different enough because, well, gas has pressure, right? Like the pressure in this room, dark matter doesn't. Dark matter just keeps going. The gas cannot advance into each other. But yeah, so overall, on very large scales, you can think of the universe as just the 25% dark matter and 5% matter sort of moving together, basically. Can't remember the order.
You said that you think the halos of the dominant galaxy and the Milky Way galaxy overlap at this point. Do you have any observational evidence for that?
No. So the dark matter we cannot see. So again, also these dotted circles that I'm drawing there, they're like guesses, yeah. Right? Because I want to be very clear about that. They're just the average of this outer radius for halos of roughly the mass that we think the Milky Way and Andromeda have, right?
No, so it's pretty hard to find observational evidence. So what I will be looking for in the next 10, 20 years, so we are going to get a lot more of these little satellite galaxies, right? So things that I've marked with these blue white red points here. So we keep finding those. It's actually an amazing evolution, right? So 20 years ago, we knew like 10, and now we know like hundreds. Well, like, no, I think we're at 60, actually.
More in satellite galaxies in between the two, which you can measure.
Yeah, so what I'd be looking for is if we keep finding these further out, right? And so we have to go to about 500 kiloparsecs. So this is quite a long distance to find these little things, but our telescopes are going to get better. You would expect that there will also be a break in these galaxies at this radius because they behave just like the dark matter, right? They've fallen, they come outside, and they're just dynamics, right? Nothing else happening except gravity. And so these little satellites, they will on average also fall in and then turn around somewhere here. And so you should see a break in the density of these. And if we detect that, I would be very happy astrophysicist that day because that would be super cool. Yeah. It would be a while, I'm afraid, just because of this distance, you know. So currently, you can see like the blue points are still at quite small radii, and there are a lot of them, right? And then it gets a lot less dense. And so to really see a break, we need to really push this to significantly larger radii. But it will happen.
My question. Two questions. Once of all, what machines do you run these models on? I take it you don't actually run them on your PC or something.
So yes. So the video I showed you, those were run back during my PhD at the University of Chicago. We had a machine there. Now I'm running stuff at Zaratan here at the University of Maryland. So we have a new cluster called Zaratan, which my department has conveniently bought a significant share of that we just get to use. So we actually, our department gets 30 million hours a year, which is a lot. So we can burn a bit.
Okay.
And then these very biggest ones that I showed you, that they were not my simulations, right? They're just other people ran those.
Yeah, sure.
They were run at some of the biggest machines in Europe. So the biggest machines are the national labs, basically. So yeah, the biggest computers. Yeah, so I think Oak Ridge has the, this changes so frequently. Until recently, at least Oak Ridge National Lab had the biggest machine in the US.
Okay.
And astronomers use those pretty routinely.
Yeah. The second question is a little more, with these models that show how galaxies sort of coalesce from the early universe, from quantum fluctuations, is there a, how do I want to say this, succinct qualitative explanation why you get filaments and point agglomerations as opposed to just the point agglomerations?
Yeah, no, that's a great question.
Where do the filaments come from? I guess it just follows out from the simulation, but is there kind of a reason for that?
Yeah. So let me pause this movie. No, I can't pause it right now. So there is a theory. It's called Zeldovich collapse after Yakov Zeldovich, who was a Russian astrophysicist. And he proposed this in the 70s. So the idea is qualitatively that indeed, I mean, if you just sort of have a ball, right, it will just collapse to a point. Yeah. And there's just by symmetry, right? There is no particular direction. But when you look at these points that are collapsing in the early universe, I'm just going to restart this so you can see the early stages again. What happens is that the distribution is never quite symmetric, right? And so you always have something that has one axis where it's a little more compressed, and then it's going to collapse a lot faster along that axis.
Okay.
Right? Because the collapse, once it happens, you can sort of see that it goes like slow, right? It goes very nonlinear, very quickly in the end. And so basically, when you have these big filaments, so you collapse one axis first, that gives you a wall, right? Like a sheet of dark matter.
Yeah.
And then you collapse your second axis, and that gives you a filament. And then you collapse your third axis and you get a halo, basically, like you get a spot. Okay. And so by virtue of that, and again, this is partly an artifact of the sort of projection that we use in these images and movies, you don't see the walls because you're sort of cutting through the walls. Let me show you a 3D print I made.
this was in the fabric of the universe, since Carl mentioned this earlier. Let me find this real quick. So because I actually think that it's really important to sort of look at structures in 3D. So here's a 3D print of the dark matter around a big halo.
Wow.
And this one, you can't see it so well. Oh yeah, so here's a video of the model in this 3D print. And so this was taken from my simulations, and then we made like a 3D surface with a isodensity surface. And you can see walls, right? Quite apparently in this, that you've never seen in these movies somehow. And that's because, any projection sort of cuts through the wall, right? But this is the Z-Ovich collapse at work, right? So you really first make these walls.
Okay, so is this then an effect? Is there some sort of a rotational effect because of the asymmetry of the asymmetry of the original gravity, so clumps?
Yeah. So
would you then get a rotational effect, and somehow the walls come out of that? I mean,
there's rotation in there as well, but I think you don't even need rotation. I think the point is that. So I think this is very generic, right? I think even if you had different gravity, if gravity wasn't 1/r² or something, I think you still get this more or less, you know, that this idea that whatever spot pattern you make initially, right, is going to have these asymmetries. Like the things that collapse, they're never going to be round, right? Because it would be an enormous coincidence if like the stuff around any given overdensity happened to be like perfectly spherical, right? It's just never going to happen. And so, I mean, maybe, you know, a few halos will have this property that they're like coincidence are very symmetric. And those will then probably immediately collapse to a point mass. But the majority of your structures, you just look at them, right? I mean, you can already see a filament here. And this is on a huge scale, right? I mean, this is like the entire sky, basically. So I think it's just a property of A, these random fields that you get from the early universe, and then B, this sort of rapid collapse due to gravity, that you generically get these cosmic web patterns. But I've always wanted to run this with very different gravity. I've never gotten around to doing it. Like, just postulate that gravity is some crazy law, like 1/r or 1/r³ instead of 1/r². You should get a totally different dynamics, right? And then you can see if the cosmic web still looks remotely similar or not.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Let's try, time for one more question.
Yeah, we have time.
Anyone else online have a question?
Yeah, me.
Go ahead, Jay.
Yeah, in one of your early graphs, you had the Hubble constant at 67.7, which is a very low Hubble constant. And people have, that one. Some people have said that it's as high as about 72. Would that make a difference?
Not for the things we've talked about today. It would make a big difference in cosmology. So the reason, so the 67.7 comes from this measurement, right? That is the Planck measurement of the Hubble constant. So if I want to match these gray dots with my lambda CDM model, right? The Hubble constant is one important parameter in lambda CDM. It's one of those six numbers that I get to pick. So I don't think I have that slide ready right now. I made a slide also where I varied H naught, and you will again see that this then messes up the curve, right? It will not match the data points. Uh-huh. So you're looking at the evidence for H naught being 67.7. However, uh-huh. You're pointing out, right, there is local universe observations. So when you look at galaxies and you're trying to measure distances to galaxies and all that good stuff, people come out with these significantly higher values, like 72, 73, 74.
Yeah.
That is one of the most interesting hotspots in astrophysics right now.
Yeah.
It's somewhat acrimonious, you know, it's quite fun.
Yes.
There's a history of people shouting at each other at conferences about the Hubble constant, and we're now back to people almost shouting at each other at conferences, which is really cool. except that back
called the Hubble tension.
The Hubble tension, exactly. It used to be whether it's 50 or 100. Now it's between 67 and 73. But still, anyway. Cool. And so we don't know, right? I mean, it could be, in principle, you have three options, right? It could be this measurement is wrong. There is something we are misinterpreting about the CMB. The local universe people are wrong. There is something we haven't understood about, I don't know, Cepheid variables or whatever techniques they're using. And the third possibility, which is becoming more and more interesting, is that our theory of cosmology is incomplete, right? That our Lambda CDM model needs to be amended, because at the end of the day, this is actually an extrapolation, right? H naught is the Hubble rate today. So in the CMB, you do not actually measure H naught, right? You're measuring a combination of other things that you can then extrapolate to predict what H naught would be in this universe, right? And so if that extrapolation is wrong because our cosmological model is incomplete, that is by far the most interesting variant, right? And that would be one where, yeah, we have to then amend Lambda CDM. But it would not mean that there is no dark matter or anything like that.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks for the great questions. This was really fun, I have to say. You guys are a great audience.
All right, so it is clear enough. So we are going, Matthew's going to go down right now and he's going to start setting up one of the telescopes so folks can kind of go observe for a little bit. We're probably going to stick with some bright objects.
Thanks.
I'm
being serious. This was a fantastic audience. I don't always get so many good questions, you know.
Yeah.
Most of them are amateurs, but they know some stuff.
Yeah, no, that is very apparent. But I love this sort of, you know, it's really fun to talk to people who don't do this every day, but who have the background that we can go into, you know, much heavier stuff than I would normally dare in a public talk, you know.
Right.
I would never show the CMB stuff in a normal outreach talk, you know, this would be suicide.
Yeah. Okay, so, when did you get that philosophy? When did it actually got built in the universal
dimensions? Oh, last year, two years ago now. Yeah, yeah. We had one called Deep Thought 2, and they retired that, and they build a new one every, I don't know, 15 years, you know. Because they age.
Yeah, because I'm noticing though with the plethora of data centers that are coming around this area, aren't any actual attempt to try to take advantage of that kind of resource?
Yeah, that's a good, I mean, I think, I mean, in a way they are. I mean, the university would always want to have its own cluster because it's way cheaper than buying power from some.
The irony is the peak of data centers and cloud is kind of the path that we're entering the draw.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Because they have gotten, as you just said, is that they've kind of gotten a little too aggressive to the pricing.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, so to be clear, like Zaratan, this new machine is in a data center. It's not actually on campus. Right? It's physically, it's somewhere.
It's not far away.
It's somewhere in Maryland, right?
But, yeah. But it's off campus.
Yeah. There's like a big fiberglass, you know, like connection to make it fast and so on. But
internet one and then back one right through the area.
Yeah. I think that's right. It's, are you in this field? You sound like you know this stuff.
Yeah. Right? Exactly. That's actually.
Yes, you know this much better than I do.
What's kind of funny is that's what I already launched now. They want to go direct to cloud. They want to go direct to cloud. Skip all the ground stations.
But I mean, for a thing like the size of Zaratan, does that make sense? Right?
Well, no. This is for space.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay, so this is just us.
Have you tried the textile museum for the collaboration?
No, I've never talked to them.
All right, we're gonna go ahead and hang up. Okay, guys.
Okay. Yes.
All right. Y'all have a good afternoon. Good evening. We'll see y'all later.
Thank you. Have a good evening. Bye now.
Good evening. Bye.
To that museum yet. I must come. Bye. So it's at GWU, basically.
It used to be on PC.